This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Macro Voices, episode 294, was recorded on October 21st, 2021. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode is brought to you by Abex Technologies, pioneering the design of smarter markets that better serve the needs of both market participants and society as a whole, and by Escrow.com, the world's most secure online payment system from a counterparty risk perspective because the funds sit in escrow. Forest for the Trees founder Luke Groman returns as this week's feature interview guest. We'll discuss the U.S. dollar, inflation, what the consequences of inflation will be, and much more. Then be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment when Patrick has another of his famous chart decks.
And I'm Patrick Ceresna. Eric, let's get to that S&P 500. Right up along its 52-week highs. What's going on?
Well, last week it was buy the dip, and everybody was saying, but wait, economic fundamentals really don't justify buying the dip. And then, you know what? Now we're a stone's throw away from all-time highs. You know, what taper? I guess we forgot about that taper stuff. I say that this market keeps grinding higher on central bank largesse. It's going to keep going up until it goes down. And, of course, that's the way markets always work. It's surprised us at how long it can keep going up. I don't think there's any reason to assume it's going to change tomorrow. Someday this will come to a very sad end, but I don't think that day is anytime soon.
All right. Well, let's touch on the dollar, which is consolidating off of its highs, but by no means a breakdown. What's your take on the dollar at these levels?
Well, you know, we still have not seen a decisive breakout above that 94.5 resistance level. So there's no news to report. As you say, we're consolidating. We're at the high end of the range before we're at the low end of the range. And one of the reasons that we wanted to get Luke Groman on this week is Luke has had a dollar bearish view. We're at the high end of the range. Want to get his take, see if anything's changed.
Eric, let's touch on crude oil. We were at 52-week highs, almost cleared the 84 level on the December contract, and here we are with a bit of a reversal candle. Obviously, not a major change in the trend, but we're several dollars off the high. Do you think oil still has more gas in the tank?
Well, Patrick, I do think that it does. We're taking what really is just a normal pullback here so far. We got below the 8-day moving average briefly this morning. We're back above it as I'm speaking now. And we never even got down to the 13-day moving average. So it looks to me like just a, you know, kind of a textbook pullback in the course of a very healthy bull market. EIA inventory came in this week with crude oil drawing down 431,000 barrels. That would be 2.1 million barrels if you also include Strategic Petroleum Reserve drawdowns. So that's a pretty small drawdown. Cushing, Oklahoma had a great big drawdown, 2.3 million barrels. And that is a counter-seasonal draw. In other words, this time of year in the shoulder season, now that summer driving season is over, the expectation is that those tanks in Cushing start filling up again because those motorists are not driving. Well, as Phil Verleger told us to expect and predicted here on Macro Voices, summer driving season is over, but summer fuel demand is not over because summer home building is continuing very much, very actively, and I think that's part of this. But what we're seeing overall is a change in dynamics of Cushing inventory, and I think that's the reason we've seen the blowout in the time spreads. Also, big drawdowns on the products this week. 5.4 million barrels on gasoline, 3.9 million barrels on distillates, U.S. production ticking down to 11.3 million barrels. That's down 100,000 from last week. So we still have kind of crazy stuff going on at the front end of the term structure. The reason that all of these front of the curve time spreads have been blowing out is J.P. Morgan had a note out this morning explaining that really functionally, because Cushing, Oklahoma has so many different grades of oil stored in it, really, when they get down to about 30% of capacity, they're kind of out of oil in the sense of having run out of some of the important deliverable grades. So Cushing is a lot closer to being running out of oil than a lot of people think. And that's why the front of the curve is starting to blow up. Now, we saw this in 2013 and 14 with the opening of a new pipeline that would provide a whole bunch of additional capacity out of Cushing, pulling oil out of Cushing. It blew up those front of curve spreads to as much as $1.60 per month. We got all the way up to $1.24 on the front spread. That's the difference between the December December and January contract. That is an indication of extreme supply tightness in Cushing, Oklahoma, even though the market overall is not that tight. Cushing, Oklahoma has a problem. That's what's blowing up the front of the curve.
All right, well, let's get to gold, because while there's a lot of action in things like the silver markets and in the gold miners, gold is really not broken out. I mean, I look at that 1800 level as such an important pivot, and we haven't cleared that yet. So it's more of a consolidation. Do you think this is the moment where gold's going to break out, or is it going to be just more of the same?
You know, I don't see any reason to think that. We've been consolidating between the moving averages. It looks like the 21 and the 13 have been support, and the 5 and the 8 have been resistance, although not as firm resistance, and much firmer resistance, up higher at the 100 and 200-day moving averages, which are co-located right around 1800. As you say, the key here is we need to see a sustained close above 1800 and stay there for a few days. That tells you that maybe something real is on to the upside. Till then, I don't think there's any reason to call this either way.
All right, well, let's wrap up with touching on that 10-year Treasury yield, which, while it's been quiet in that space, has been slowly crawling higher. We're slowly approaching those March-April highs where we were up in the near 175, and we're trading right around 167 basis points right now. Anything new in your mind in terms of these bond markets?
Patrick, no real change in my view. As I've said before, I don't think there's any reason to conclude that that the bond market is about to crash. Last time we got to historic low yields, they stayed there for 10 years. And I think we're going to be in a period, for the reasons Lacey Hunt has explained on this program and elsewhere, we're going to be stuck with very low bond yields for many years to come. The demographics and deflation and so many other factors just lead to that. And as far as exactly which way we head from here, I really don't have a view.
All right, this week's feature interview guest is Forest for the Trees founder Luke Grohman. Eric, why did we get Luke back on the show this week?
Well, Luke is one of our listener favorites, and we really love hearing from him. But particularly, you know, the dollar is kind of at the top of its range, and Luke has been an outspoken dollar bear. I wanted to see if there was any update in his view.
Eric's interview with Luke Grohman is coming up as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor.
This episode of Macro Voices was brought to you by Abex, a fintech company traded under ticker symbol ABXXF on the OTCQX in the United States and ABXX on the Equitas NEO in Canada. Abex was founded on the principle of creating market-based solutions to solve the world's most challenging problems. Two of these issues in particular, the energy transition and climate change, are creating once-in-a-generation opportunities for investors. Abex is leveraging proprietary Web 3.0 technologies to digitize and accelerate the velocity and security of commodity trading markets, beginning with liquefied natural gas and carbon. Investors seeking exposure to the fintech applications powering this new era of the ESG economy can visit www.abex.tech or www.abex.exchange, or check out ABXX on the Equitas NEO or ABXXF on the OTCQX exchanges.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Forest for the Trees founder Luke Grohman. Luke, it's been since January that we had you on the program. Really great to get you back. I've been asking everyone about secular inflation. Now, everybody can see that there is inflation. My question is this really transitory the way the government would like us to believe, or are we seeing the beginning of a structural inflation that's going to last many years?
I think it's the beginning of a structural inflation that's going to last many years. I should probably say thanks for having me back on to start. But the reason I think it's structural, lasting for many years, is I think if you look at a lot of the key factors that have been disinflationary over the last 20 years, 30 years, a lot of them are going in reverse. So, you know, whether you go back 10 years, we've seen a disinflationary impulse in oil and commodities, in no small part tied to U.S. shale. U.S. shale has been the biggest marginal producer of oil for the last 10 to 15 years. We are seeing that it is getting hard, if not impossible, to increase production at lower prices. And so we've been talking about peak cheap oil. That is a inflationary, structurally inflationary component to commodities. I think there's If you look at another big one, globalization. Globalization has been extremely disinflationary or deflationary for 20 plus years. Very clearly, that is going in reverse. And so if China and U.S. trade was deflationary or disinflationary, the breakdown of U.S. and China trade relations, it strains credulity to think that that too is deflationary. I think that's a very inflationary, secular inflationary impulse. I think when you look at even things that are a little bit more counterintuitive to me, I think they also point to a secular inflation. So for example, it's often pointed out that in the U.S. demographics are deflationary, that old people don't spend as much. I would question that a little bit, particularly at the consumer level. And the reason I say that is if you look at U.S. deferred compensation schemes, whether they be 401ks or 403bs or IRAs, all of these programs effectively amounted to the sterilization of inflationary U.S. deficits over the last 30, 40 years. And in plain English, people could put away 10, 15% of their income. And instead of having that income in pocket now, the reward was you got tax deferred status. So you put that money into assets instead of putting that money in your pocket where you would have spent it and where it would have been CPI inflationary right away. And so effectively, we were sterilizing inflation with these deferred compensation schemes for 30 or 40 years. Fast forward to today, you've got whatever it is, 70 million baby boomers. There's an article in the Journal last year or earlier this year noting that the estimate is that the boomers control roughly $35 trillion in assets. And now they're all getting to an age where they have required minimum distributions that it's a technical topic, but for simplicity's sake and just sort of, you know, good enough for government work, they have to spend about 3% of that money per year. And so again, if deferred compensation schemes were disinflationary or sterilized inflation that would have been higher for the last 30 or 40 years, and instead it resulted in asset price inflation, then again, the opposite, this $35 trillion coming out secularly is also very inflationary. And so I think there's a number of factors, and those are just three. There's probably some others I could come up with. I think they all point in the direction that there is a secular, we've seen a secular shift in the deflation, disinflation versus inflation impulse. So that's some thinking about it.
Luke, I started with that question because I've been asking everybody that question because, frankly, I think this issue of secular inflation, and that's what I think it is the single most important topic in macro today. You told me off the air, though, that you actually think that those of us who are looking at it that way maybe ought to be looking at it a little bit differently because you think there's something else that's really, I don't know if it's more important, but maybe more important to start with to understand this situation. What's the something, Luke?
Sure. So, yeah, we were talking off the air. I think the single most important macro chart that we have and that we're talking about and that I'm told virtually no one else is talking about, and I think it also feeds into this being much more structurally inflationary than most people think, is, or many people think, is the fact that if you look at the U.S., what we call the U.S.'s true interest expense, which we define as treasury spending plus entitlement paygos, right? The pay-as-you-go portion of entitlements, because those are just the interest, effective interest to support the entitlement obligations. And you add those two numbers together, what you find is that those two numbers are still 111% of U.S. tax receipts as of the third quarter per the Treasury Borrowing Advisory Committee. And that's with tax receipts at all-time highs, inflated by slash aided by an epic everything bubble. And so this, I think, is an element of the structural inflation that virtually nobody's talking about. And I think it's something virtually everybody should be talking about, which is everybody for 40 years has been conditioned that once we see these types of inflation, the Fed steps in to fight the inflation. And the problem is that there have been no instances in the last 40 years where the Fed has begun a tightening cycle where the U.S. couldn't even afford to pay its interest out of tax receipts. And that's the case now. If we look at true interest expense, again, which is the Treasury spending plus entitlement paygos. And so it leads to this conclusion that if the Fed tries to tighten, what you're likely going to see before very long is a decline in tax receipts. If the U.S. puts the if the Fed puts the U.S. into a recession, and we're obviously seeing significant slowing already, you're going to be looking at tax receipts that are already below true interest expense and probably would start falling further, while the true interest expense would probably rise because of the interest rate going up. So there's this angle that basically every other cycle that basically every trader alive and listening to this has lived through, the choice has been inflation or slow the economy and eventually maybe make a policy mistake down the road. But what this means is that the Fed's choice is now, it's binary. It is, you know, unless the Fed is willing to tighten and then stand aside as the U.S. government does not have the money to pay interest expense, true interest expense, without the Fed's help, then basically the only choice is the Fed keeps helping and the Fed keeps monetizing as they've done for the last 14 or 18 months. And so that is, I think, you know, arguably when I had that list of structurally inflationary factors before, arguably the most inflationary factor is this dynamic that the U.S. government needs inflation to run hotter than it is today to inflate tax receipts to much higher nominal levels, GDP to much higher nominal levels, so that the U.S. government can cover its true interest expense. And then we can get into defense, education, labor, national parks, veterans affairs, everything else they're spending money on. But right now, the U.S. government doesn't even have the tax receipts to cover true interest expense. And so to me, it doesn't suggest they can't or won't raise rates. It just suggests that if they actually withdraw liquidity, it's probably going to be pretty volatility inducing and really, really bad for risk assets pretty quickly. And then I think the Fed will very quickly have to reverse track, which I think will be very inflationary. So that to me is the most important chart in macro, is that the chart we have showing true interest expense still running at 111% of federal tax receipts, which are at all-time highs, aided by an everything bubble.
Luke, I personally couldn't agree more with you. I think you've made an extremely sound argument based on logical, rational thought. But hang on, the folks that are in charge of policy don't, in my opinion, really subscribe to that whole logical, rational thought thing. The way they would react, I think, at least the MMT crowd, to everything that you just said is, Luke, you don't get it. You're acting like it's a problem that tax receipts are not enough to pay the interest. You're totally missing the point. Taxes, according to the MMT crowd, and I want to stress, although I don't agree with this, the MMT crowd are rapidly gaining a huge amount of political capital in the United States and elsewhere around the world. What they're saying is, look, the whole purpose of taxes is just to you know, deal with inflation. And the paying the bills, all you have to do is print money, and that's better. That's the way we should be doing it. What we're seeing here, Luke, is finally a sign of improvement, and we need to dramatically accelerate the rate that the Fed prints money, not fear it the way you're describing. Now, I don't agree with that at all, but I think there's more people who disagree with us than agree with us, and you know, the market kind of goes where the crowd wants to take it. What does this mean? Does it just make it worse? Does it mean the inflation outlook is worse, or does it change it? How do you interpret this if you assume that potential policy response that's coming?
Oh, I do assume that potential policy response. I think the odds that the Fed tightens and then stands aside as rates go up and stocks go down, and the U.S. government has to decide if it wants to keep funding defense or send checks to baby boomers, I think there's zero chance that happens. And that's, if you have two options, and one of those options has zero chance of happening, politically and economically for that matter, then you're left with whatever's left. And whatever's left is they're going to print the money. And so I think the MMT crowd is exactly right. I think that's what's going to happen. And I think the reason the MMT crowd suddenly has an ear in Washington is I think there's enough people in Washington that are looking at the math and they can't make 2 + 2 = 6 trillion. And they're going, okay, well, how do we make 2 + 2 = 6 trillion? And, you know, the MMT crowd comes in and says, hey, well, you could just, you know, you could print 599,990,000, you know, whatever that number is. And Washington goes, okay, great. MMT sounds awesome. And so I think part of the reason why MMT is getting the traction it's getting, I think MMT getting the traction it's getting is simply a manifestation of, you know, the fact that there's no other option. It's the only way you can get the math to work. And so once you understand that, you know, if I'm right about that, and that's why I say this tax receipt still being below true interest expense is the most inflationary thing possible, and virtually nobody's talking about it, particularly in the context of this rate hike cycle and, you know, what we're seeing euro dollar futures do, discount rate hikes in 2022, because the only possible answer is they're going to print so much more money than anybody thinks possible, which is fine. It is what it is. Like, this was always how this was going to go. COVID just pulled it forward.
Luke, the usual prescription for fighting inflation is higher interest rates. And I would say also that most people just equate the idea that, well, you know, more inflation means there's going to be higher interest rates. Does it really work that way, that interest rates follow inflation, or is it only the case that central banks respond by intentionally increasing interest rates, and that's the only reason that they respond with inflation? And particularly, what is it going to mean when in this inflation, the Fed's probably not going to be able, as you say, to do that? It seems to me, Luke, that that potentially sets up this catalyst where at some point you have a market realization that they say, wow, the inflation is running away. And even though, you know, they predicted it in Macro Voices years ago, we all just realized something, which is it's running away and they can't fight it. If they fight it, it'll screw something else up that's even worse. They're powerless and it's running away. It seems to me like that aha moment of, wait a minute, this time around, there's really no good remedy for inflation that central banks have in their quiver. That's how it feels to me. Now, maybe I'm missing something. Maybe they have lots of remedies that I'm not seeing, but it feels to me like they're kind of running really, really out of bullets here.
Oh, absolutely. I think they're absolutely out of bullets. I think the last bullets they have left is by repeating that it's transitory. And obviously that bullet, you know, they've fired that a few times and they're now sort of being forced to admit by events that, maybe it's not exactly transitory. And then the last bullet I think that they really have, really the last two bullets, if you will, is bullet number one is the lie that inflation's whatever, 2 or 3 or 4, whatever the heck they say it is. It doesn't really matter. It's laughably low. And so if they can sort of contain the Overton window of discussion to, oh gosh, CPI is 3 and not 2. It might go to 4. Inflation expectations are 5. Oh, you know, that's their last, it's jawboning. They're jawboning. The reality is inflation is probably running 8 to 10. Maybe it's running higher at the moment. They're sort of trying to keep the discussion of exactly how negative real rates are, you know, to a minimum level to delay that aha moment, right? Because if we woke up and they said, well, okay, guys, real rates are actually negative 14 right now, the bond market's going to lose its mind. And when the bond market loses its mind, I agree with your point that historically the Fed would follow the bond market. But again, this is the first time, I don't know, in at least 100 years and maybe more. Well, it's the first time since World War II, certainly. Let's go back there. So 70 years, it's the first time since the end of World War II that the U.S. cannot afford rates to rise. And so if, you know, step one, bullet one is lie about what inflation is to keep the degree to which real rates are negative, you know, minimalized, right? So that's step one. But then step two is going, if eventually either it's going to be recognized or if they were to be truthful about how negative real rates actually are right now, the bond market's going to start selling off. And once it sells off to a certain point, the Fed's going to have to cap yields. And it will be that decision. Does the Fed want the release valve to be yields, or does the Fed want the release valve to be its balance sheet? And the only political and economically palatable choice is for the release valve to be the Fed's balance sheet. And at that point, you'll just see, and what it'll just start feeding on itself. And the Fed's balance sheet will go 8, 15, 25, 30 trillion, whatever the number is. Inflation will, you know, officially go from 5 to 7, and it'll be running at 20 or 30. And after, you know, 5 years of 20% inflation, U.S. debt to GDP will be back down to 70% from 130% as GDP skyrockets while interest doesn't. And, you know, bonds will go from buying you filet mignon to buying you dog food and, you know, a bond. And that'll be, that will then be the position where the Fed can raise rates again. They can normalize policy. And I think that's the prescription. I think that's the prescription. I think that's where we're going. I think we are much closer to that aha moment than we were 6 months ago. I think that aha moment might be in the next 6 to 12 months, but we'll see. But it all feeds back into that structurally inflationary outlook.
Let's talk more about how big the aha moment actually is, because maybe I'm, I don't know, making up a story in my head, but it just, it feels to me like most people are not seeing the secular inflation argument. They seem to be largely persuaded of this transitory argument. The moment where you get to the vast majority of market participants roll their eyes and know that the Fed is full of it when we know what's really happening here, aha. It seems to me like that could be just a profound change where everybody finally realizes, oh my gosh, we really are at the beginning of a 1970s-sized inflation. I don't think we're anywhere close to it, and I don't know why I say that. I haven't, you know, taken surveys or looked at statistics of sentiment, but it just feels to me like most people don't get it yet. Would you agree? And what do you think it could mean? How big is this aha moment, and what could it mean as a market event?
I agree most people don't get it yet. I think the reason most people don't get it yet is you know, it's sort of the common knowledge game that Ben Hunt has talked about, right? It was like, you know, everybody in Hollywood knew Harvey Weinstein was a bad dude, and nobody talked about it. And then all of a sudden, everybody talked about it, and he was canceled, and he was arrested, and, you know, going to jail or whatever, however that worked out. I think it's the same thing. We've seen it. I think there is, particularly as it relates to the U.S., this exceptionalism. We've got the reserve currency, and, you know, it hasn't happened in my lifetime, so it's never going to happen, you know, which was, by the way, the exact same thing everybody said about home prices falling nationally 15 years ago, even though it had happened before, it just hadn't happened while they were alive. So for their view, it hadn't happened. And, you know, I think the Afghanistan situation is a perfect example, too, right? I mean, that was, you know, 20 years ago, we invaded a place called the Graveyard of Empires with no debt on our books. We were running surpluses. And the overwhelming consensus was we had the best military in the world. And so the Graveyard of Empires would not apply to us. You know, we have the best military in the world. We have the reserve currency. And so, you know, what could possibly go wrong? 20 years later, we're massively indebted. We have outsourced our manufacturing base to China, or at least a quorum of it. We had no adversaries then. Now we have a big adversary who has gone, you know, as of last weekend, shooting hypersonic missiles around the world while we were busy chasing guys in, you know, in Toyotas with technicals on the back of them. So there's this aha moment, right, where, you know, I think it's going to be like what we saw at the end of Afghanistan. It's like, well, the Taliban will never overtake Kabul. Well, it'll take 90 days for the Taliban to overtake Kabul. Well, it's going to take 3 days. Well, oops, they just overtook it. And I think the key in all of this, whether it's the Weinstein situation or home prices or the Afghanistan, it's the combination of an ignorance, a willful ignorance of the politics of the situation and dogma. And so I think right now people just say, well, you know, I don't think they're aware of the politics of the situation. And by that, I mean, if you are just repeating to yourself that debt is always deflationary, yes, that's true, until the sovereign is where the debt reaches. And that's a different game, because once the sovereign gets into too much debt, the question is, are they going to print the money or not? And they always print the money. They always print the money. And, you know, people say, well, Japan. Well, Japan's a twin surplus nation that has a net international investment position of positive 70% of GDP. They could at any point call in the positive 70% of their GDP that is sitting in foreign assets. So they could call the U.S. and say, okay, Mr. U.S., we want you to send us 4% of our GDP every year in net assets for the next 70% divided by 4% is what, 17%. So 17 years in a row, Japan could literally just take 4% of their assets or foreign assets and bring it home. The U.S. doesn't have foreign assets. Our net international investment position is negative 70% of GDP. We're running twin deficits, not a current account surplus like the Japanese. There is no foreign assets to bring home. The foreign asset to bring home is you pick up the phone, you call up the Mariner Eccles building and say, hey, Jay Powell, print us more. And that's where I just think that between the dogma of, well, you know, we're the U.S., we have the reserve currency, it's not going to happen, you know, ignoring the politics of, do you really think they're going to cut off 70 million baby boomers? And then just not realizing the difference between us and Japan, which is their massive current account surplus, massive net international investment position, you know, to the positive versus us, or twin deficits, negative net international position. So I just think as we move forward, you know, when does this hit the aha moment? I think it's all of these factors have always been true. It's sort of like the Weinstein thing. It was always true. There were jokes about it in the 90s. So when does everyone go, oh God? Because it's true, when they go, oh God, it's not going to be like, oh, it'll take years and years. It'll happen fast. And so, you know, to me, that trigger is probably, for my view, it's Fed tries to tighten, it goes galactically wrong, stocks go down, yields go up in the treasury market, Fed comes back in and does another $3 trillion or $4 trillion in QE. And then that might be the aha moment where everyone goes, oh my God, they're never getting out of this. Every time anything goes wrong, the balance sheet's going to go up non-linearly. And then it starts to get interesting, right? Because now you've got all these structurally inflationary factors anyway, they start to become really embedded. And then, you know, we just inflate the debt away until it gets to a level that they can normalize policy without blowing things up.
Let's talk about what this is going to mean for the stock market, Luke, because if I assimilate the different things that you're saying to me, first of all, it seems politically that the Fed really needs to stay on their, look, we're tapering and we're serious about it, messaging, at least for a while longer. And what you're saying is if hypothetically they really and truly meant what they said and they were going to just, you know, normalize their balance sheet and that's it, the market's on its own. I think you and I agree that would result in an outright market crash, really big bad news. But we also agree there's no way that they're ever going to actually let it go that far. It'll get to a certain point and it'll be the Fed to the rescue as usual. Well, that all sounds like just the right narrative. But wait a minute. It sounds like I can't use economic fundamentals to make any investing decisions because this whole thing is about politics and policy. How do you navigate this in terms of asset allocation?
I think you got to go back. I mean, I think you got to go back to the economic books as they apply to emerging markets with balance of payments crises, with balance of payments problems. Because if you take the masthead off of the US's, you know, sort of term sheet, except for the reserve currency, which is a huge, you know, exception. Don't get me wrong, but obviously you and I've talked at length about how that is being chipped away by a number of different factors, et cetera, et cetera. But if you take the U.S. flag off the masthead, our setup looks like an emerging market with balance of payments problems, and foreigners are not buying our treasuries. That was sort of, you know, the key part of the reserve currency as far as this balance of payments goes is we ran balance of payments deficits, twin deficits, and foreigners financed us. And increasingly, they're not buying treasuries. They are basically buying our stocks, right? So we are effectively selling corporate America and American real estate to the Chinese to finance U.S. government spending, which is fine. There's still capital flowing here. Politically, we're seeing where that's becoming a problem, but that's a bit of a separate issue. But they're not buying the treasuries anymore. And so once the U.S. was a massive twin deficit nation whose treasury debt was no longer being bought in sufficient amounts by foreign central banks or foreigners in total, you put down the USA 1971 to 2014 economics book and you take out the, you know, Argentina playbook, or you take out, you know, Turkey, or you take out any number of twin deficit nations, not because I think they are going to necessarily get that bad, but that's the same type of dynamics. And that dynamic is when twin deficit nations lose their foreign financing, inevitably the central bank begins financing them. And that's where we are. And the Fed's done a great job of saying this isn't them financing, that they're not monetizing the debt. And, you know, they can say they're not monetizing the debt all they want. Bernanke said in 2011, they were going to take the balance sheet back down to, you know, whatever they started at, $800 billion, right? Which is where it was in 08 when things went pie-shaped or pear-shaped. And the fact that they have not gotten it there means they've monetized the debt, which is fine. It is what it is. This is how it was always going to end. But I think that's what you have to start doing in terms of asset allocation is, you know, it's not the U.S. of 1971 to 2014. It's, you know, it's the U.S. with Argentine characteristics of 2014 through, you know, probably 2030, you know, whenever, however long it takes us to inflate enough of this debt away that they can kind of go back to the U.S. of 1971 to 2014. And, you know, if they're going to inflate the debt away, I think you want to avoid bond markets. And I think you want to own assets that do well as they're inflating the debt away. So it's, you know, it's Bitcoin, it's gold, it's equities, it's commodities, it's real estate. I mean, look, the U.S. government is giving Social Security recipients next year a 5.9% COLA, cost of living increase, at a time when the Fed is holding mortgages at 2.9%. by buying $40 billion a month of them. And it's like, okay, you're going to give me a negative, mortgage rates are negative 3% real. Okay, I'll buy a house. But what about prices? Well, they're paying me 3% to buy a house. Okay. You know, that's, it's this emerging markets, economics playbook that you just have to transition to from, you know, the developed market, the reserve currency, you know, developed market that we all sort of grew up under.
Well, Luke, if you want my prediction of what is not going to play in American politics, it would be the day that labor is saying to the government, why are you allowing our Fortune 500 companies to send all of our jobs over to China? And the answer is, because China owns our Fortune 500 companies, and it's kind of up to them. And, you know, we say this stuff kind of sarcastically, but it's the direction that we're headed in. You know, we're selling off corporate America to foreign investors so that they can set the policy. And it is U.S. government policy that is causing that massive foreign investment in U.S. equities. And I don't think anybody's really looking at the big picture of where this all is headed. Let's talk about bond yields now, though, because, you know, a lot of people I'm talking to are saying, look, as much as we see some inflationary pressures, the situation, as you've said, Luke, is the government can't possibly afford to allow bond yields to rise meaningfully. So, look, we're stuck here at basically super low yields for the next 10 years. You know, don't even think about a big bond short. You know, it's not going to be your inflation play. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Yeah, I wouldn't short bonds here by themselves. I would short bonds the finance 101 way that I just described, right? If the Fed wants to hold mortgages at 2.9% while the government hands out a COLA adjustment to Social Security of 5.9%, great. I'll borrow the money. I'll short the dollar. I'll short the bond that way, right? I'm short a mortgage, and I'll buy the real estate. And I would want to own that. That's how I think. If you want to short bonds, and I think that's a good way to do it, I think that's the way you do it, is you borrow the money, short the bond, the finance 101 way, borrow the money and buy the underlying asset, because that's exactly right. I think it's the political imperative, the political economics of the situation is the debt's so high, the deficits are so high, we're so deindustrialized, there is no ability to raise rates in any real way. And so the Fed will have to cap rates. And you know, I think, you know, there are very smart and connected people saying they're already doing so on sort of a pseudo basis, quietly. And if I was them, I would be doing as quietly as I could too, because the day they come out and say we are moving to yield curve control, that, you know, if you ever hear the Fed say yield curve control or its equivalent explicitly, that they are announcing explicit policy of that, that will be the Fed checking into the Hotel California. They will be saying we are going to grow our balance sheet until we've created enough inflation that U.S. debt to GDP has gone from 125% today to 70%. And at 70%, we will be able to raise rates without blowing up the world. And that will be that. And so if I'm the Fed, I am trying to never have to say YCC, yield curve control. I don't think they'll be able to avoid it indefinitely, I should say, but ideally they just sort of do it quietly. But yeah, I agree. I don't think rates are going to go up a lot, you know, beyond certain points. And we're probably getting close to those points when you look at things like the 30-year and the 10-year treasury bonds.
Luke, something just crossed my desk today. I saw an article talking about junk bonds and the number of junk bonds that are now negative yielding in real terms. So you stop and ponder that. You're literally paying a premium for the privilege of accepting default risk when you buy those bonds. That's what it is.
Yep.
And it seems like that's got to be the most screaming short in the history of finance, that you could just short all of these junk bonds because they just have to crash. Well, wait a minute, Luke. I had that idea more than 5 years ago, and I lost a shitload of money shorting junk bonds way too early. How do we know when it's time? I mean, I think you and I and our listeners can all see that this junk bond situation of negative real yields on high-risk credit is insane. It doesn't make any sense. But it hasn't made sense for a long time, and junk bond prices keep going up.
When does it make sense? I think you'll know it's time to short that when the U.S., I think the key to watch is U.S. debt to GDP. When U.S. debt to GDP is at 70%, not 125%, then I think you can consider putting on that trade. But until a rise in rates anywhere, you know, until a rise in rates anywhere blows up the system. And again, if the system goes into any deflationary impulse with U.S. true interest expense still above tax receipts, the U.S. government says, sorry, we're not making the coupon payment on treasuries. Sorry, 70 million boomers, you're getting less money this month for Social Security. Until they've inflated this thing enough that that is comfortably no longer true, I would rather structure the trade differently, which is, again, that finance 101 way. Don't short the junk bond. Just buy Bitcoin, buy Ethereum, buy silver, buy gold, buy you know, commodities, buy stocks, buy, you know, an ocean house, buy a lake house, buy something that is more finite than, you know, the silliness that you're seeing in the bond market. And then again, once U.S. debt to GDP gets down to 70%, which is probably, again, you're talking about 20% inflation for 5 years, then okay, maybe you can see rates rise. And at that point, I think all those hard assets I just laid out are probably worth a lot more than they are today. And then, you know, you can decide, okay, I want to, you know, what's the coupon that I want to own, that, you know, that I'm willing to accept for, you know, these assets. And but I think the metric to watch, and this gets back to that point of you know, the economics books, what economics books are we watching for? It's all about the sovereign. Once the U.S. government has delevered enough by basically screwing bondholders on a real basis, then I think you can, you know, think about shorting bonds nominally. But until then, I think bonds will be fine nominally, but I think they're going to continue to get killed on a real basis, particularly relative to Bitcoin, stocks, gold, houses, etc.
Luke, let's touch on the U.S. dollar, a subject that you've been extremely outspoken on in the past. What we've seen, and I think it was very much showing that you had been perhaps right, was a lot of weakness earlier this year in the U.S. dollar. It, according to some people, has turned around. We saw the bottom at 89, and you know, it's all uphill from here. We're headed to 120. What's your take? Is the U.S. dollar demise still on, or what's the timing? What should we expect to happen next?
I think what we've seen, I think empirically, if we look back, the level of the dollar as measured on the Dixie that blows up the world has been falling steadily each cycle, right? So in 2017, 2016, I guess late 2016, right? Dixie, if I remember right, got as high as maybe 106, something like that. And, you know, then, you know, 2020, it got to, you know, 98. And it started having problems. And then, you know, a couple of weeks ago, we got the 94. And it's like, you know, the market starts having indigestion. You know, there were some other factors that worked there too. So I don't want to ascribe all of that to that. But that makes sense. And in a world that is short dollar debt through the, you know, the euro dollar system, and that euro dollar debt keeps going up, and the U.S. debt keeps going up, and the world keeps becoming more interconnected, and the rest of the world keeps becoming a bigger part of global growth and U.S. growth, then over time, the level of the dollar that you need to hit before things start going pear-shaped comes down. And we're seeing that. And the flip side of that is, and we saw this last year, is, so that's sort of, you know, if you think about it as a graph, right, the level of U.S. dollar that creates a crisis is a line that is going down and to the right. At the same time, the level of the dollar on the downside that creates a flood out of the dollar is a line that's going up and to the right. And I think we saw that earlier this year where we got the dollar down to whatever it was, 88, 89. And, you know, we're seeing, you know, Bitcoin at 61,000 and lumber at whatever, 1600, and oil's still going up, commodities still going up, stocks going up. There was this basically wholesale flood out of the dollar. And I think over time, that number goes up. Because I think as the debt rises, as we get closer and closer and closer to this aha moment where more and more people realize, oh my God, they're going to have to cap yields and inflate away the debt, there is this sort of level of the dollar that below which you're going to get a run out of the dollar. And I think the Fed wants to avoid that. And the challenge is that those two lines are converging. So if you think about the upper bound as being the level of the dollar that breaks the system, starting, you know, going down and to the right, and the bottom level of the dollar that creates a run out of the dollar, which from the Fed's eyes also breaks the system in a different direction, that number is going up and to the right. in between there's the Fed's operating room. And the Fed's operating room keeps shrinking and shrinking and shrinking. And so I think right now that range is, you know, 89 to 94. And, you know, a year from now, it'll probably be 90 to 93 and maybe sooner. But eventually those two lines are going to cross. And that where those two lines meet, that's our aha moment. Because now there's no policy to do. There's no, and I think then we get sort of the flood out of the dollar into sort of everything else. We get our significant inflation in a compressed period of time. And, you know, then the Fed, after, you know, they inflate away the debt enough, they can normalize policy. But that's how I really think we've been watching that action in the dollar really since 2016. Ultimately, I think it will be resolved with a much weaker dollar. You know, at any given time, if the Fed doesn't do enough, though, you can get dollar spikes. And we've certainly seen that in 16 and then again in you know, 19 to a lesser extent, 20, certainly early on. And then the stronger dollar we've seen since, I would call it May, when the Fed started jawboning that, hey, we're going to taper and it's transitory and sort of this, you know, playing the only, you know, the only couple hands they have left.
Luke, you mentioned Bitcoin a couple of times. I wouldn't be the slightest bit surprised if Bitcoin is over 100,000 less than a year from now, let's say 6 months from now. No, that doesn't mean my view on cryptocurrency fundamentals has changed. My view is that this week the ETF started trading. That means that the people, and how it's possible that people have money to invest and were unable to figure out how to buy Bitcoin, it's now idiot proof. Anybody can buy Bitcoin. And my prediction is that all of the stupid people who were unable to buy Bitcoin before because it was too hard now have an ETF to use. And I think it could dramatically increase interest in Bitcoin over the next year. I wouldn't be surprised if it's a setup for a blow off top and a crash, but boy, huge capital inflow. What do you think? Does that make sense? What are you expecting?
Yeah, I could easily see it being 100,000 a year from now, probably sooner. Again, I think it depends on policy. Look, I think if the Fed came out and said, you know, as an extreme, if the Fed came out and said, listen, we've got an $8.3 trillion balance sheet and it's going to be zero by Christmas, yeah, Bitcoin probably would go down quite a lot, along with pretty much everything else in the economy, et cetera. So it all, I think, is dependent on policy. But I think the level, you know, how draconian policy would have to be to stop the freight train that's Bitcoin rises, you know, almost by the day, you know, so I see Bitcoin going a lot higher as well. I think the ETF thing, you know, to me, it's still way easier to buy Bitcoin on Coinbase than it is through a brokerage account. And I don't know that this changes that. Where I do think that this could be a game changer is if we start seeing the Bitcoin ETF show up as a 401k option. You know, so for example, for me right now, I don't have that. I can't touch that money. It's sitting in, you know, sort of older, traditional, we'll say, financial instruments. Would I have an interest in having money that I don't need to touch for 20 years and putting 20% of it in Bitcoin? Yeah, I would do that. I would absolutely do that. And my guess is I'm not the only one. So I think to the extent that they create this, you know, this ETF and it allows its introduction into deferred accounts, you know, where you don't have to worry about the day-to-day volatility. You just have to go, all right, it's probably going to be higher in 20 years than it is today. That, I think, could be really powerful. And I agree, that could absolutely, I don't know, a blow off top, but I think it could certainly drive it meaningfully higher over time.
Well, you know, it just occurred to me as you were speaking that regulatory changes will have so much to do with this. Because if you think about it, a lot of people think the reason that gold is not a whole lot more popular is because FINRA regulations, basically professional financial advisors, are not allowed. It's against the rules for them to say, hey, you should be doing what I'm doing in my own personal portfolio, which is, you know, I'm 40% in gold or whatever their number is. I'm just making that up off the top of my head. It's against the rules for licensed financial advisors to recommend a large allocation to anyone other than an accredited investor because of suitability rules. And, you know, as the rules get defined, it's brand new, uncharted territory. What is the maximum percentage allocation of a retail investor's portfolio to cryptocurrency according to FINRA rules that haven't been written yet? Well, I'll tell you what, when they get written, they're going to have a huge impact on the market. And it's going to have nothing to do with whether Bitcoin is valuable or not. It's going to have to do with the rules for who's allowed to recommend them to customers. And I think that knowing things like what's coming next out of FINRA in terms of suitability guidance for cryptocurrency is going to be huge trading edge for anybody who's got that information, because it's going to define how this this gets adopted. Would you agree? And where do you see that heading? What do you think is going to happen in terms of, you know, criteria that will eventually be established for suitability of retail investors investing in cryptocurrency?
I agree. It would be a huge edge to know that ahead of time.
Some people do. They're making lots of money on it, Luke.
Don't get me started. Yeah, right?
No, it's only China that has corrupt government officials. Never happens in North America.
It's not corruption. It's lobbying, Eric. Just you have to get the terminology right. No, I think it raises an interesting game theory question that I think applies not just to retail investors, but I think it applies to central banks too, which is Bitcoin, as structured, is effectively tied. It's a neutral reserve asset with an energy tie and a decentralized, and it has an algorithm that's going to increase its value as the aggregate amount of the economy grows. It's very, very elegantly beautiful. And the point is that at some point, central bankers, again, I'm going to take it to the extreme because extremes inform the means. At some point, Bitcoin would, if taken to the extreme, completely make irrelevant central bankers. They're completely irrelevant. The cost of capital, allocation of capital will be set by Bitcoin. And if it's allowed to get to that case, so the question then is, okay, when will central bankers realize this? I think they do on some level, but I've generally been naive to relative to how much credit I give them. But at some point, they need to defend their franchise. And the only thing they have on their balance sheet that can defend their franchise is gold, right? So it's been in central bankers' interest to kneecap gold. And we've seen how effectively they've done that. They can't kneecap Bitcoin because it's decentralized and because there's no unallocated gold market like there is in London that's allowed to expand their leverage, you know, effectively infinitely, etc. So it's interesting because to me, you know, I love Bitcoin. I also love gold because I think at some point central bankers are going to be smart enough to realize they need to defend their franchise. And the only thing they have on their balance sheet to defend their franchise is gold. And the only way to do that is basically take the ceiling off of gold and let it go to its real price. Does that mean gold will beat Bitcoin? I don't know. But it does mean that gold would probably, you know, add at least a zero at the end of it, maybe two. And so that's to me, it's why I think Bitcoin and gold are allies in that way. That's why I still own both. But how that relates to your question about the FINRA thing is I think it's the same game theory of financial advisors is at some point, you're going to have enough, you know, major asset managers and RIAs that are seeing assets walk out the door and, you know, going to, you know, Coinbase and then moved off of Coinbase into any number of custodial options that allow people to self-custody assets, et cetera. And, you know, I don't know what the level of assets that have to walk out the door for FINRA to sort of defend its franchise or to have the RIAs and what have you around the world to defend their franchise. But I think there is a level of assets that takes place. And so I think that's how I would frame sort of the regulatory side. I don't think we're there yet, but with as fast as Bitcoin and crypto is moving, I don't think we're 5 years away either. We're probably 2 years or less to that happening, both at the central bank level and probably at the FINRA level too. So, you know, let's see. I agree, like I said, that knowing ahead of time any of these things, it's going to be a political decision, and it's, you know, probably going to benefit those who are able to get in front of it ahead of time.
Luke, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview. But before I let you go, please tell our listeners what they're going to find at fftt-llc.com. That's the Forest for the Trees website.
Absolutely. So we've got a number of different links there, some information about how you can find out more about our retail investment products, our institutional investment products, a little bit more about what we're up to. You can also see what we're up to on Twitter at Luke Groman, LukeGromen. A pretty active Twitter feed there. So yeah, either place, check us out, and appreciate you for having us back on.
Patrick Serezna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor. Escrow.com is the payment system for buying and selling anything of value. Cars, boats, airplanes, jewelry, gemstones, fine art, collectibles, intellectual property rights, domain names, bringing in shipping containers from overseas, or even buying and selling entire businesses. It's simple to use. Either party sets up the transaction, then the buyer sends the funds to Escrow.com. The seller is then instructed to send the goods to the buyer to inspect. Within the inspection period, the buyer can return the items for any reason. After that, Escrow.com pays the seller immediately. Escrow.com is the world's most secure payment system from a counterparty risk perspective because the funds sit in escrow. Over 2 million customers have transacted over $5 billion on Escrow.com, and eBay and Shopify use it for cars, boats, luxury watches, and business sales. It's available in the United States, Canada, and Australian dollars, euros, and British pounds. Never buy or sell anything online unless you use Escrow.com. Escrow.com is a subsidiary of Freelancer.com, listed on the OTCQX Best Markets under the ticker symbol FLNCF, and the Australian Securities Exchange under the ticker FLN.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, was great to have Luke Roman on the show. It's always nice to hear his views. He's always such a big picture thinker in terms of some of the ways that think the macro picture will have to evolve in the years to come. It's always great to get his views.
Patrick, let's jump right to the chart deck, which is titled Talking Charts this week. Listeners, you'll find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, it means you haven't registered yet at macrovoices.com. Just go to the homepage, macrovoices.com, click on the red button that says looking for the downloads. Patrick, we got the S&P chart. Boy, right back up to flirting with, not quite as we're speaking yet over the previous all-time high, but just within a stone's throw. What's going on?
For sure. Listen, we are testing the previous highs. It's interesting the equal weight S&P has actually broken to a higher high. And what is particularly interesting is that there was a very good recovery in many of the FANG stocks, which really allowed this S&P 500 to make that next push higher. And nonetheless, this really neutralizes the sell cycle that we're in. I'm not by any means turning outright bullish, but certainly the sensitivity or the vulnerability that the market was in just a couple weeks ago has been neutralized, and it'll be really interesting to see whether the pattern of bulls defending little dips starts to emerge, which is something we've seen through the entire rise since November.
Patrick, let's move on to the VIX on page two. Holy cow, is that not quite a 52-week low, but since July anyway.
Well, that certainly has been a tailwind for the market on the short term as volatility came right back down to 52-week lows. But what's really interesting here is that that's been a tailwind. Now it's at a major resistance. So at least this is what's, in my mind, causing the stock market to at least potentially stall up along the highs. But what will be really interesting in the weeks to come is whether volatility breaks to 52-week new lows and actually heads back to the bottom end of those ranges. Nonetheless, let's move on to the next chart where I have that crude oil, and that's that bearish engulfing candle that's forming at the top of crude. And what's interesting about this one, Eric, is that it's not that the trend has changed by any means. The bull market is very well entrenched in this chart. But usually when you have a reversal candle like this, sometimes it drives these consolidation periods where for several weeks, the price goes and backfills and establishes a base for a continuation pattern. It'd be really interesting to see if the price action just takes a break here for a little while and whether this is the beginning of it, and that's certainly on my mind on that chart.
Patrick, let's move on to gold futures on page five.
So Eric, when we're looking at this gold chart, what is interesting is that descending trend line and just is really marking the top of this downtrend. And what we're going to be watching for is whether or not gold can break out. But what is interesting about that is that when we look at page six, where we have that chart on silver, silver has legitimately broken out of its descending channel. And more importantly, has wiped out the entire September sell-off in the process. This is usually the typical start of what it looks like when a bigger bottoming formation is beginning. It'll be really interesting to see in the next sell-off whether or not silver makes lower lows. If it doesn't, it may very well create a very classic bottoming formation that may end up being the big turning point for silver. So that's certainly what's going to be on my mind here in the coming weeks.
Let's take a look at bond yields on the next few charts.
All right. So, Eric, when we're looking at the yields on pages 7, 8, 9, and 10, really one thing I just wanted to really highlight is that it's the entire move has so far been in the belly of the curve when we're talking about the yield curve. When we look at the 2-year and 5-year yields, there's been extraordinary breakout in the yields, at least on a technical basis, relative to where they've been consolidating. That's clearly some inflation expectations maybe being priced in. But what is interesting is when you look at these charts and look at the magnitude of the moves, as you go farther in duration to the 10-year, which hasn't broken out to a higher high, or to the 30-year, is nowhere near the first and second quarter highs. And that continues to show that even though the front of the curve is pinned by the Fed funds rate, really what we're seeing is a little bit of a flattener as the farther and longer dated yields still have not started to move in any magnitude relative to the fives and twos.
Listeners, you can get Patrick's chart text every single day with a free trial of Big Picture Trading. You'll find the information at bigpicturetrading.com or on page 11. We're going to leave it there for this week's show. This episode is brought to you by Abaxx Technologies, pioneering the design of smarter markets that better serve the needs of both market participants and society as a whole. And by Escrow.com, the world's most secure online payment system from a counterparty risk perspective, because the funds sit in escrow. Patrick, tell them what's in this week's Research Roundup.
Well, this week, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to the chart book we just discussed in the postgame. There's also a link to a David Einhorn article, Inflation is Here to Stay, and Powell Has Not Lifted a Finger. There's also an interesting interview with Paul Tudor Jones, where inflation could be worse than feared and the biggest threat to markets and society. You'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at macrovoices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend. That's Eric spelled with a K, and myself at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week, free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.